Please note that this podcast contains references to conflict-related violence, including sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised. 25 years ago, the world made a promise to protect women in conflict and to ensure they could lead the way toward peace. For the Women, Peace and Security event, we spoke with six remarkable individuals about this shared mission. This six-episode series brings you those conversations in full. In this episode, Patrick Kamaert from the Netherlands.
My name is Patrick Kamaert. I'm a retired Major General of the Dutch Marine Corps, worked for the United Nations, and my most important job was the General Officer commanding the Eastern Division in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
When was the first moment that you realized you want to work in protection, responsibility, justice?
Not in my younger years when I joined the Dutch Marines, because I joined the Dutch Marines because I wanted to have adventure and responsibility at a young age. I was also accepted to study medicine in Amsterdam and in Nairobi, but I'm not a businessman, so that was quickly out. I always have been doubting on to be a medical officer, medical doctor, or in the Marine Corps. I choose for the Marines because of the adventure. And then this whole issue of the protection of civilians under threat, that came, in fact, later. That came when I started joining the United Nations, and my first mission was in Cambodia in 1992-93. And then you got the feeling of, we are not immediately in war fighting, but we are in peacekeeping, which is sometimes more difficult than war fighting, and with a main emphasis on how can we protect women and girls and men and men and boys as well from a particular conflict-related sexual violence.
How was that for you? Like, what moved you?
Well, I mean, the fact that you saw firsthand the incredible results of this war and between the Khmer Rouge and the atrocities that they committed in Cambodia, that really was something that hit me like a brick wall at the beginning. And certainly also the amount of landmines and personal mines that were laid in that war, millions and millions of mines. So you had every 24 hours, my people had a mine victim. And then we had a field dressing station, the level 2 hospital, where we had a surgery capacity. And then those people were brought in, and then our doctors were operating them, amputating and all the rest of it. So during the pre-deployment training of my people, we emphasized on what are you going to do when you see on the road a child or a woman or a man, you know, being hit by a mine. And if you're not prepared for that, you don't know what to do. But since we prepared well, my Marines had a very, you know, personal system in how to deal with that. They had in their rucksack little things so that they could immediately help and were mentally able to deal with a situation that the child is blown to pieces, still alive, but losing limbs and feet and hands, etc. And that you are emotionally able to deal with that. And that was for me the first time that I really saw, wow, yeah. And also the first time that you went into areas that were heavily mined, and we had no mine protected vehicles. We had Land Rovers and we drove there, and you had to sand back under your seat in case you were hitting a mine so that the blast would be in the sandbag. But nowadays you have beautiful, very effective mine protected vehicles, but not in those days.
But that sounds like quite a lot already, like on your first mission.
Absolutely, a lot. I was during those training, we were not trained because we didn't know about conflict related sexual violence. That word didn't exist at that time. But we took over from a previous battalion. I was a battalion commander, and we had units all over our sector, which was an important sector because all the warring factions had been in that sector, and nobody else but the first commander had chosen the Dutch to go there because, you know, we were well prepared, we had good training and equipment, etc. But it was when we took over one of the units from a country, then my Marines were in that compound, and they were you know, a bit surprised and confused, because there were young boys of, let's say, 10, 11, 9 years old and came to the fence and were saying, sucky, 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 sucky. And they had no idea, you know. But that was just the previous troop contributing country was, you know, involved in sexual services of young boys. And that was the first time I was really shocked. I mean, I really, and my Marines as well. I mean, they said, you know, what the hell is this? So they sent them away and I come, you know, this is not us. But that was the first time where, let's say, the bases were, the foundation was laid in previous or in the next, you know, so many missions that I did, that there was an alarm bell in my head ringing, you know, when these kind of circumstances were mentioned to me by my people, say, hey, be careful, because this smells of, you know, sexual violence, harassment, sexual exploitation and abuse and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you the importance of protection of civilians, which is at the basis of a deployment or in peacekeeping, because the local population expects you to protect them. It doesn't even have to be written in a mandate. It's, in my view, an implied task. It's a raison d'être. That's the reason why you go there. So the people, the local people see, the United Nations is there. They will protect me. We have that kind of responsibility. So for me, that was very much rewarding as a military commander, because you could really contribute something if you wanted, because a mandate is as strong as the will of the troop contributing countries and the leadership to implement it, because it comes always back to will. Because, you know, if you deploy in these kind of, you're not going to Club Mediterranee. Eh? You are going to volatile areas where there's fighting. And even later in my career, when I went to the Congo in particular, was a lot of fighting. So, you know, if you are not willing to take any risk, then you can better stay home, because you make a nuisance of yourself, because the local population say, why are you here? You're not protecting us.
Why do you think your real is so big?
This is my mandate that I get from the Security Council. They say you deploy there with so many thousand people, and your mandate is to protect civilians under imminent threat or under threat, including for conflict-related sexual violence. Okay, now, if that's the case, then you do everything possible to patrol and to make areas safe, and that people can go back to their villages, and that they can go, the children can go to school, that there is a safe area where people feel confident and have the confidence in the United Nations, because we are making sure that that area is secure. If you have troop contributing countries with you who are not willing to do that, that is one of the major problems. So then you have to push as the leader of the gang, you have to push them to do it. And say to your subordinate commanders, if you don't do it, I do it, but there is no room for you. So you have to go out. So your choice.
And what is something, do you think, that many people don't know about your work, but is definitely part of it?
Most of the time we are in the papers when we don't do what we are supposed to do. I've never seen an article in the paper that the United Nations is too active, you know, we are protecting too many people. No, you always see the negative part, that troop contributing countries are not going out in the dark, are sitting in their compound, are not doing what they are supposed to do, because they are risk averse, because the government many times say, hey, poco poco, don't be so proactive. The key word is prevention, because you have to prevent those atrocities to happen. In order to prevent it, you have to be proactive. You have to find what we call hotspots. Where are things going to happen? I'll give you an example. You know, you have a patrol and you either you drive or you walk and you see women in the field working. You wave, etc. That's fine. But it's even better if you make sure that you can contact them and talk to them and find out what's going on. And then you find out that they work in the field during the day, but they sleep in the bush during the night. Why? Why are they not going back to the village? Because they say, well, the last couple of weeks, we see people, armed people who are not from our area, roaming around. They're stealing from us, and we are afraid that they will be raping us. That is a hotspot. That means that your patrol must immediately report that so that you can quickly disperse a stronger force in that area to disarm those people and to make sure that the locals are feeling safe and secure again. You know, that is how it works. But that means that not everybody feels that way because their government says, oh, don't be so proactive. And reactive means you are too late. If a woman has been raped and you react, then you are too late. Slow murder has started.
Then you constantly have to be on.
Yeah.
Well, how does that work?
24/7, you have to be on. Yeah. One of the things that really, and I mean, most of the time I'm talking on the missions that have made the most impression on me and where I had the most influence, you know, that was in the Congo. Not so much I was being force commander in Ethiopia, Eritrea, but that was a good practice run for my deployment in the Congo. So the Congo was very volatile, very violent. And we had to really use a lot of force to make sure that things quiet down. And as I said, many times you see that units are not doing what they are supposed to do. That frustrated me enormously. And then you are in a mood of frustration. You are angry. You are sad because you see the suffering of the local population. You're sad because, you know, you might have a problem at home or whatever. So when that situation came to my eyeballs, more or less, I jumped in a helicopter and then flew to a place called Bukavu. And Bukavu is the capital of the South Kivus. And you have a hospital there that's called Panzi Hospital. And Panzi Hospital has started and is run by a doctor, Dr. Dennis Mukwege. And Dennis Mukwege, he got the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago. And he became a good friend over the years. And then I flew to his hospital. And then in that hospital, they treat women and girls between 3 and 83 years old for rape and gang rape. So then I walked with him in the hospital. And then those women, even in their misery, smiled to me. And then I felt after an hour and two cups of coffee, I felt that my problems were melting as snow in the sun because I had no problems. My problems were nothing, nothing. They had problems. And that gave me an enormous amount of motivation to fly back to my headquarters. And then, you know, for the next 3 months, I had motivation to push my people because I saw and I smelled, you know, the victims of that violence.
Have you ever been anxious?
Not so much anxious as well as emotional. I've been sitting with Dr. Dennis Mukwege with a girl of 14 years with a baby born out of rape. And he had fixed her because she was badly wounded. And then he said, this is the second time that she's here. And I have to let her go because we have no room for her. So he said, you know, in 3 months' time, probably either she's dead or she's back. And we both cried. Even Dr. Dennis Mukwege, he had seen 15,000 patients. We both cried because it gives you such a feeling of helplessness, you know, and sadness and anger that no one is really willing to do something about it. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo, because also bloody corrupt, you know, to make sure that those women and girls are safe and sound and that they can go to their village and to their school, etc. So not so much anxious as well, very sad, very sad.
And how do you deal then with that emotional part of your work?
In these circumstances, it's always important to have someone that you can talk to and can share those emotions, those sadness, etc. Now, the higher up you become in the ladder of responsibility and command, the lonelier it becomes as well, you know? I was the boss of 15,000 troops, men and women, in an area twice as big as France. But I had a French former lieutenant colonel with me who I knew from Bosnia, etc. And he was a very calm person smoking a pipe. And then, you know, sometimes I was yelling at him and screaming, etc. And he said, you know, oui, mon général, you know, blah, 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 blah. So he was calming me down. And, you know, I met my present wife in the Congo in 2005. She was working as a political officer in Kinshasa, and I was working, my headquarters was in Kisangani, 2 hours flight. But I could talk to her, and still, you know, all the things that I'm still seeing going around, I can talk to her because she understands what I'm going through. And so you need a person that you can share those emotions with.
If you see so many very worst cases, like, how do you still keep the hope?
Because, you know, a lot of people say, okay, you've been to a number of missions, but you see that many times those missions fall back to you know, bad situations. That's true. But we also, you know, Sierra Leone, Mozambique, Côte d'Ivoire, you know, you have also areas, Angola, where things are going okay. And also, in the meantime, you still have protected thousands and thousands and thousands of people. They're still alive because you were there. And sometimes, you know, I was in Ethiopia, Eritrea. We separated the countries. It goes, you know, for a long time, goes very well. And now it is still shaky because of the leaders at that time. But you cannot say, well, you failed. No, we didn't fail. And in Cambodia, we were very successful with the first elections, fair and free elections. Okay, you have a government that is still in power since 1992. But you and I go on holidays to Cambodia. We go to Vietnam and all those places. And it is maybe not the system, the democratic system that we want, or maybe that have people have been fighting for. But at least people can go to school, they can go to university, they have food on the table. Maybe they don't have all the freedom that we have and we enjoy, but still we have contributed to that. And that gives you, you know, a feeling of reward. And you can also say to yourself, when you're looking in yourself in the mirror, I tried to the best of my abilities, more I cannot do more. You know, I cannot take all the problems in the world on my shoulders. But in that little thing that I did, I can say, okay, I did, I tried. It, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work, but I tried. That gives me, you know, let's say, the meaning in life.
When did you first hear from the resolution 1325? What did it mean to you?
I heard from 1325, that was in the year 2000. Because I gave sometimes presentations also for the UN, because I was already involved as a force commander in Ethiopia, Eritrea. And then over the years, I was sometimes invited to present for the Security Council. And in 2008, I gave a presentation on sexual violence. And then, you know, I had a sentence, it's more dangerous to be a woman than a soldier in armed conflict. And that sentence has been used and still being used many times in, you know, in presentations that I see, et cetera. So I was always, you know, involved in this women, peace, security issue. And in 2015, you had Security Council Resolution 2242. That was 15 years after 1325, where there was a kind of update on where are we now. And now the 13, we live in 2025, so we have now 25 years, so where are we now? And I was in the advisory board in 10 years ago, in the advisory board of the global study that was performed by Undersecretary General Radhika Kumaraswamy from Sri Lanka. And Radhika asked me, because I did some work for her when she was the Assistant Secretary General for Children in Conflict. And she sent me as an envoy to Sri Lanka to see what the Tamil Tigers and the Tamil did with, and the Sri Lankan government did with the kids there. So she knew me and she asked me if I could be in the advisory board. So I mean, all the time over the years involved in that. And I gave a lot of presentations on when to use force, what is it to the mandate, the rules of engagement, be proactive, be aware of what conflict-related sexual violence is all about, how can you prevent it, and all that kind of stuff. So it has always, from the very beginning onwards, when I was first commander in 2000, I was interested in it. And it also inspired me because, you know, you can do a lot of things. And I've seen firsthand how important it is that women are at the table in the negotiations and ceasefires. And as we speak in Gaza or in the South Sudan or in Sudan, in Jeddah, women are not sitting around the table. Nobody, you know? And if you want to have a solution and listen and talk with women instead of talking about women, you know, it's very important that you have them around the table because they have a different angle. When I was in Hodeidah in Yemen, negotiating between the Houthis and the government of Yemen, many times I had two women in my little delegation, and they were sitting, you know, next to me, etc. And sometimes when we broke into little groups because I gave them a task to negotiate and to talk, I let those women sit and with the Houthis and the government of Yemen. And people said, wow, but, you know, women are looked at very differently in that society. That's true. But if you have a woman around the table, that gives you already a certain amount of authority. And me, as the head of the mission, I gave them in front of everybody that authority and that trust. So they had no escape to say, you know, I don't want to talk to women. No, sorry, that is my, she is talking on behalf of me. And they were very successful. Many times they got more things done than me, because a woman has a better feeling and can read the room many times far better than men. And that is something that, you know, when you put a delegation together, get as many women in that delegation because they make a difference.
Why are there still no women at the table?
First of all, the people who are pulling the strings don't think about it. They have a different view on gender than maybe I have or others have. Others means the people who are pushing this WPS agenda. And, you know, they are not acknowledging or don't even know from experience what it means to have a woman in your delegation who sits and talk. I've lived for two and a half years in Bamako in Mali when my wife was the chief of staff there. So I saw many times villages, and I listened to people. In the villages, you have the female committees and et cetera, also dealing with small projects. If you see how even in their, you know, simple surroundings, how well and wise they are in their daily running of the business, and how they give many times men stick because they are, you know, only on the booze and after the women. You know, if you have that kind of experience, you are more tempted to say, okay, come and sit with me on the table because you have an important task there. And if you have women as the special representatives in peacekeeping or peace support missions, it brings a special dimension in when you talk with each other.
Why did you choose to fight so much for the woman?
I feel that, you know, you must make sure that people should be treated equally. I still don't understand under 2025 that if you and I are in the same job, then in many countries you get less pay than I. And I don't understand why. Why is that? You know, I don't understand. And from that onwards, and seeing in missions and the deployments, you know, how badly many times women are being treated, and there is no reason for it, because, you know, they bring the same thing to the table and sometimes much more. It is important that men in general are saying this, because always it is conflict, rape, sexual violence, ah, it's a women's issue. No, it's not a women's issue. The perpetrators are men. It is men can do something about it. And if we are not involved in that and treat women equally, then you never make progress.
I'm curious, like, what are you most proud of?
I'm very proud in during the 2.5 years that I was in the Congo, that we really made a lot of progress in the protection of civilians, and in particular, women and girls, because I felt that, you know, I still had that energy at that time, certainly, and motivation to push my troops to the limits of doing what they were supposed to do. And we made, as I said, we made a lot of progress there. And that is something that always, you know, I felt proud of. And at the same time, what I see now, so many years later that colleagues of mine later, you know, were not pushing the envelope and not pushing to the limits, because either they were, you know, concerned about their career, or, you know, many times I say, don't rock the boat so that you can get your promotion at home. And that was is something that you see nowadays. And I had nothing to lose. I mean, I was major general. I was commanding a division of 15,000. I was a happy man. So I said, you know, we go for it. And it inspired me enormously, my visit to Panzi Hospital. That really made a life impact. I can tell you that, you know, those people who were suffering on sexual violence so much, that you understand also better nowadays when women are harassed or raped or whatever, what kind, it's slow murder. It's not murder, it's slow murder. If you are murdered, you're dead. But slow murder is every day you die a little. And that made for me a huge impact. And that's why I've said, you know, I was so motivated when I was there. So the Congo is for me also a very rewarding one. You know, in Hodeida, I had a very interesting moment, which was also rewarding for me. The two parties were extremely difficult. And I had only, when the Secretary General Guterres asked me to go there 2 days before Christmas, on a very short notice, because of the implementation of that ceasefire. So I went there with a small team, and then we were negotiating with the Houthis and the government of Yemen. And there was in the front line, because every night was heavy fighting, in the front line, there was a huge warehouse with millions of tons of grain. And there was famine. I mean, people were dying also of starvation. Just before I left New York to go there, on the New York Times colored magazine in the weekend was a cover photo of a woman, a field, with a little skeleton on her lap in the hospital in Hodeida, because there was no food. So when I was negotiating with the two parties, the first thing I did was I wanted to open that warehouse with grain to get the food, as a kind of confidence building measure between the two. That failed because the Houthi didn't, they promised, but they didn't want it. And then at a certain moment, you know, I said, okay, I want to see that hospital that you have here in Hodeida, a little hospital. So I went there, I was received by, let's say, between 15 and 20 men, only men. Now, my interpreter was a woman from Iraq. So she was the only woman, but she had to interpret. So then I got blah, 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 you know, this and the statistics, etc. So I said, after 5 minutes, I had enough. I said, thank you very much. Do you have female doctors here? Yeah, we have female doctors, but you will see them later. I said, no, I want to see them now. Consternation in the room. So I said, no, I'm not talking anymore. I want to see those women. So 2 minutes later, five doctors came, field five. They were sitting there. I could read in their eyes the surprise that they were called. So three were not talking English. Two were fluently in English. So I said, tell me what's going on. What's going on here? In 20 minutes, I had all the problems on the table. Domestic sexual violence, domestic violence, bombing, famine, you name it. And during my conversation, the men all the time tried to stop it. But no, I said, no, continue, because this is very important. So then I said, okay, thank you very much. Can you show me where you work in the hospital? So they walked me through the hospital. And then I came in a certain area where those women sitting in the same picture as the New York Times colored magazine. They were sitting on those beds with their little skeletons on their lap. Sophie, I'd never seen that in reality, never. It hit me like a brick wall. I thought, wow. And they looked at me with big eyes, the mother and the child. You are going to help me. You are going to save me. And I knew that I couldn't, because 3 days later, the kid is dead. It hit me enormously. So then we were outside and they asked, can we make a picture? Those doctors, those female doctors. So we made pictures, etc. And then they shook hands with me and said, we felt so empowered because you listened to us, you spoke to us, you encouraged us, and you show interest. We felt very empowered. That was for me, well, made my day. At the same time, when I came back in my little compound, you know, I was crying alone because, wow, you know, you felt so helpless. And then I had the next day another meeting with the two parties. That was the only time I lost my temper. Because they were still about this warehouse. So I took my colored magazine, I threw it on the table, and I said, you know, these are your children, Yemenis children, and you cannot even agree to feed them. I said, you know, I'm going home. I have enough of this. And I walked out. Was consternation in the room. Oh, what is going to happen? So they came to, please come back, and listen to that. That was the only time that I lost my temper. But it was for me also enormously rewarding, even if I was there for a relatively short time because I simply had no more time. Rewarding to be there and see them and to give them a little bit of feeling of empowerment, even if it was that much.
You're very powerful and powerless at the same time. It must be very crazy to balance between that. But how has your understanding of leadership changed over the years?
I'm not good in being the second in command. I'm not good in that. I'm not a deputy. I like to be in charge and take the responsibility. And over the years, I've always been in these kind of positions. You know, you grow into it. You start with the responsibility for 30, and I ended up with 15,000. So that is something that you grow into. And I tried always to avoid that I was a job in as a staff officer in the Ministry of Defense. I don't like that, you know, pushing paper and then they throw it out because it's all negative and there's no money. I like to be with the troops in the field. That's what I like, you know, because in the field, where you not have your higher headquarters on your shoulder, you can do a lot of things. You can bend the rules a bit, and you can maneuver, and you can push yourself, and you can make so. And that is when you asked me the first question at the beginning of our conversation: what motivated you? That was adventure. I liked that adventure, and I still like adventure, and I still like to go. Like I said, to go to South Sudan to do this investigation. Because I was back in the field. I love that. You know, and then you see a lot of people that you have been serving over the years. They say, General, how are you? This and that. That's nice. That's nice.
What would you say to a young commander about protecting civilians from your wisdom?
Go, do it. Do it, you know. Take calculated risks. If you do it and tone your resilience and that determination, and you have women with you in your platoon or whatever, you can do so many things. I always say, you know, the moment that you do too much, then the United Nations or somebody else will say, don't be so active. Then you look very innocent and said, I didn't know that. That's a rule in the book. Oh, I don't know. I mean, the rule in the book. I don't know this book. So you look innocent, but do it. That gives you the inspiration.
If you have one message to the world, what would be that?
The message to the world is that you get more women in senior positions to be in support of negotiations and ceasefires. And because they bring also automatically more awareness of the problems that we have on the ground. So if we can achieve that, and that the world has a commitment to do that, then we have made progress.